Welcome to the TechNerdy Podcast. I'm your host, Scott Catoon. Joining me on today's show, founder and CEO of Catalytic, Sean Chow. The show is obviously a very good one, and it's obviously very centered on automation. Although, at the end of it, we did kind of wrap up a conversation that I think is worth noting for everyone. I'm not smart enough to strategically put it at the end so you'd listen to the whole show. It just sort of worked out that way. But there is a lesson in not only running your business more optimized and more efficiently using automation and solving for what Sean calls the run-of-the-mill, you know, usual daily activity, which is about 80% of your business. Most of that, not only through Catalytic, but other means, can be automated. It's not about that as much as it is taking the benefit of that and using it to either increase your output, to reward all of your employees and customers with better experiences, but more importantly, being aware of all of the different opportunities and things that are out there. I mentioned to him how much I hate when people say, give it 110%. What is awesome about automation in business and in other things is that you literally can give 110%, because 50% of what you're doing daily, your daily activity, is automated. So that still counts. And then you save that 50% and reallocate it to people to do other things like volunteering, paid volunteering, where they actually get to be paid to do things that they would like to do, to new product development, to testing and trying things and innovation meetings internally. There's so many more places and things that you can do with automation. And I think it's a fascinating understanding as a CEO in the future of what exactly it's like to run a business. That and a lot more is the conversation with Sean. Also, he goes through the origin and the importance of automation, which I feel like we gloss over. We just say AI and we move on from it. There's so much more to it. Some of it is minutia. It's HR and legal, but a lot of it actually impacts why Teslas haven't been able to do full automated driving yet. All of this stuff is sort of wound together in data, and Catalytic is there to sort of unwind this data. This is my conversation with Sean Chow. So I'm going to lead this conversation off. Obviously, automation is going to be a good portion of this, but I had an interview with a guy who runs a company called Humatics, which he said he wanted to start. This is a fellow who literally wanted to build this business 25 years ago, but realized in his studies at MIT that it was going to take 25 years worth of knowledge to get into it. And the business, if you're not familiar with it, it's a robotics, but ultimately, and I think it's really a good segue into this conversation with you, is he set out to solve the problem of where are we? As human beings on Earth, where are we? Yeah. And when he talks about it, he means literally the pixel of space in front of us. Did, like, if I could make the air in front of us down to the cubic, you know, centimeter, millimeter, or even smaller, a digital, a fixed number, his mind, which is way past my abilities, his mind set out to solve the problem that if we could tell the robots where to go, it would be half the job for the robot. And now he's way past this. Like, his technology and hundreds of patents are responsible for part of finding the Titanic. Like, this is how big this is. And the reason that I bring this up to you is automation is also a space that is not, I don't think, too far off from, I mean, obviously there's an automated aspect to robots and what the world will do, but how we manage the data, how we manage the operations, how we actually tell them what to do, I think human beings forget that the robots are programmed, again, by human beings. And so they have errors, and the errors are inherently ours, not theirs. And if we don't have a proper place to collect all the information to give the robot or whatever, the software, whatever it is, the appropriate description of what we intend it to do, it won't do it.
Right.
And that's a spot that I think I can't even begin to get into the mindset of a person who would try to solve that. And yet you are one of those people who is setting out to solve this in your way. And and it's, I'm very fascinated to know about Catalytic and its business and how it's gotten there, but almost more so I'm fascinated to know about you and your brain and how you decided this is what I'm going to do.
Okay. So that's
no
a
pressure.
That's a big lead in. So Humatics, I think, is solving kind of a very big problem that covers both physical and, you know, kind of, I guess, cognitive aspects. We're really focused on more office work. So in many ways, a much smaller scope of things that we're going to try to do. But you said something that I think is really interesting, which is that automation is programmed ultimately by humans, and therefore its errors are our errors. And I think that actually brings up like an interesting point, which is, when does automation become AI, and what is the hallmark? And maybe one of the hallmarks, I'm just kind of thinking out loud here, maybe one of those hallmarks is actually when the errors actually become self-correcting by automation. Like, when it is actually, when do the errors actually become the errors of the robot or the automation? And that's when you really go into general purpose AI, which I think actually we're pretty far from today. You know, when you think about what we're trying to do, what Catalytic is trying to do, it really is on the simpler tasks. So when we think about automation, when we think about AI, the tasks that automation is really well suited for are simple types of tasks. If you think about our day-to-day office work, there's half of the stuff that you do, like what we're doing now, having a conversation, thinking about things, making things up, dreaming things. Those are not well suited for where the state of AI is, certainly not well suited for automation. But when you go back to your desk and you're going through and triaging your emails, going through spreadsheets, looking up something, filling out a form, sending out something to notify someone, those are very, very mundane tasks that you can push off onto automation. And so for us, in this early stage of automation of office work, those are the sorts of tasks that we're trying to tackle first.
So with that, I want to actually reintroduce this conversation and kind of bind the two, because the Humatics point was, in his mind at least, and this is David Wendell who is doing this, and in his mind, he's trying to marry digital with physical.
Yeah.
Right. And
like almost metaphysical.
Yeah. Oh, well, yeah. I mean, oh, yeah. Literally.
Yeah.
And where this gets interesting is, you know, for those out there that are thinking of like Terminator, you're thinking of like robot and big arms of like metal arms moving things around, which is applicable. I mean, you think of Amazon warehouses and stuff, but where it really is something that is right in front of our face is automated driving.
Yeah.
So the driving piece of this is, and this is his words, two parts need to be solved, and we're nowhere near truly solving it. One is affixing a digital stamp on every single molecule of air in front of us so that the car knows exactly where it's going to go and where it's supposed to go. But more importantly is, to your point, is the data component, the errors. So right now we have to go back and do, I mentioned this again, a postmortem on what, and sometimes unfortunately literally in automated driving, on what went wrong.
Yeah.
And in order for this to be something ubiquitous and actually out there and available to the general pop, it has to be auto-correcting. It has to take little pieces of information, which could just be the time it took from this car at this speed to stop in front of this car at this speed, and how quickly a person may or may not get out of the way of an object. Like, that all has to be thought of and corrected in an algorithm and then turned into something real.
Well, and what happens when you have to make that moral decision where all possible outcomes are bad? Right, like it's not a question of am I going to hit someone or not hit someone, but who am I going to hit?
And which one should I hit?
Yeah, yes, exactly.
Which is like this sounds really terrible, but it's true.
Right,
I mean, robots will kill when given the option. And I don't mean that in a weird...
anything given, you know, limited into like a set of bad options has to pick one of bad options. So if it's AI responsible for it, it actually becomes a really hard question of what do you do? Who ultimately is accountable for that decision? Right. Is it the AI, which then would also imply that it has rights and all this other stuff that
this gets into Minority Report.
We're not ready to have this conversation.
Tom Cruise is ready for Minority Report 2. Yeah, we'll get into this. I just thought that there's no better way to get the audience jazzed about doing legal automation and talking about HR and catalytic. I thought I'd get them all jazzed up on talking about automated cars and robots.
Yeah, automated cars and robots. I mean, we talk a lot about Terminator. I think people love to bring up Terminator. But if you really think about our day-to-day office lives, you know, where so much of our time is spent doing what we would call data processing. I mean, you know the definition of data processing. The definition of data processing is you're preparing data for digital consumption, right? So the definition of data processing is that we're working for robots, essentially. We're working for a machine to prepare data for a machine. That's like 30% of knowledge work. So we are already spending 30% of our time serving a machine. So we talk about Terminator in a world where, you know, we're serving a machine. But really today in knowledge work, we've kind of inadvertently done that to ourselves. We've inadvertently made ourselves as humans, when we're doing a lot of this knowledge work, working essentially between systems. So we're taking data from one system and then we're just transforming it in Excel. And because we haven't really glued the systems together, we're pushing it into another system. And so as you see this proliferation of systems with a lot of these different point solutions and cloud systems that are easy to bring in, but very hard to talk to another system, that has driven up the amount of data processing that you're doing. And that's really driven up the need for automation.
So the quintessential question is it better to work for machine or for your investors and the board?
Well,
which is more
personal
stressful?
Question. I mean, you know, for
in some regards, like I love the subjectivity that I can always bullshit my way out of anything.
Yeah.
And you can't do that with an algorithm, but sometimes the algorithm is more fair.
Yeah. As a investor, as a entrepreneur, your mission is clear. All right.
Yes,
your mission
very
is to serve
supposed
your,
to be.
All right. Your mission is to serve your investors. Your mission is to actually serve all of your shareholders. Right. But part of that includes serving the machines, because they're actually the means by which you get a lot of this stuff done. Your systems, Salesforce, your accounting systems, your, you know, all your instrumentation, those machines are all necessary for you to do your job as a CEO, or for you to really convey your success to your board or to your investors. And how do you get that data in? I mean, some of it's actually the actions itself, but a lot of it is people taking data from my Salesforce and then transforming it into something that then I can push into a PowerPoint presentation.
So let's talk about that on the catalytic side of this.
Yep.
What do you guys do, and how does it work with all these different companies?
So the to take a big step back, the general mission of Catalytic is to help companies with empowering their employees to help them be able to automate more of their knowledge work. Right, and when we think about the category of work that we're really after, it is these mundane tasks. It is these sorts of things like working with systems, working with Excel spreadsheets. But what we're not doing is bringing brand new technologies to the table. Like, we're not inventing something like this Humanix inventor brought. Like, we're not taking something fundamentally never before seen and showing it to our customers. What we're doing instead, though, is you have all this work that can be automated today with existing technology. And we're not bringing you something new. What we're doing is we're actually taking this concept and all these different technologies, and we're making them incredibly easy to use. So fundamentally, what we're really doing is we're making this promise accessible. And that's, I think, the transformative power that we're going after is, why is this stuff not being done? Why is it not accessible? It's just too hard.
So I think from the standpoint of any business operator,
yeah,
I think that they struggle, and we've had so many people on the show, whether it's, you know, talking to Relativity or talking to Stuart Frankel from Narrative Science,
yeah,
about the understanding, and it matters across the entire organization, but the CEO and the C-level in particular, understanding the value of data and what they want to get out of it.
Yeah.
And before they can figure out how are we going to track it, how are we going to use it, how are we going to, you know, measure it, they have to understand fundamentally, like, what is the data that we have access to,
yeah,
how do we collect it, and why do we want it?
Why do we want it? I mean, that's, I think people start getting into collecting data for the sake of data, and before,
yes,
you know it, you just have this proliferation of data, and you don't know what to do with all of the data. So I think the first thing you really want to understand is, why are we collecting this data? It's very easy now for us to just say we're going to collect every bit of information that's coming in, and it's just going to sit there and be dormant because storage is so cheap, compute is so cheap. So with data, which a lot of people say is the fuel of AI, you really have to have an intent for it. You have to have a purpose. And when we think about data, a lot of it is just I think of it as instrumentation. So if you're running a company, or if I put myself in the shoes of our customers and saying what our customers need to do to be successful using our technology, either way, no matter what you're doing, the data needs to serve the purpose of instrumentation. So if you're flying a plane, your instrumentation panel is your data, right? It's telling you your direction, it's telling you your height, and it's giving you all this essential information. Same thing with running a business, same thing with running a process. The data needs to be your instrumentation. It needs to tell you whether or not you're being successful. If you're not being successful, it needs to tell you why you're not being successful. What do you need to do to course correct?
So what are you doing specifically with businesses in order to make them be able to put their data to work?
Well,
I should say, like, what do they need to do? Like, if they were to start engaging with you, what do they need to do in order to even be in the conversation?
So remember, what we're ultimately doing is we're going to make their processes more efficient. We're going to automate a lot of their work. So they may have a process, let's just say onboarding an employee, right? And currently onboarding an employee takes 1,000 hours and 6 weeks. Fundamentally, what we want to do is transform that so it takes way less time, maybe 200 hours, and takes days instead of weeks. So that's kind of the overarching purpose of what we're even, why we're even there.
You mentioned Salesforce. Can you talk to them about their onboarding of vendors?
Yeah.
Because right now, that's a pain point.
Yes, it is a pain point. Customer onboarding is a pain
point. Oh, my goodness.
Vendor onboarding is a pain point. But so think about the mission for any sort of process, right? I'm talking about onboarding an employee, but it could be anything, right? Vendor onboarding. And then now let's kind of back into where data actually plays a role in this. So if my purpose is to actually end up at half the time and, you know, a quarter of the cost, then I have essentially the data that helps me know where I started and where I'm going to end up. But also in automating that process, I mean, what really is a process? It's a series of actions, and it's all the data that's flowing from system to people and so forth. So there's the data flow that's going on. So to complete a single process, the data is essential to actually marshal from one system to a person to another system to a document and so forth, right? So onboarding a person, think about that. You're collecting information from them from the get-go. You have resume information. You have information you're going to put into payroll. You have all the information you need for provisioning. So there's this data stream that's running through the process. Now, if you've done that multiple times, so if you've now onboarded 100 people, now you don't have just one stream. You have a series of these different data streams. And that's where AI and that's where machine learning really starts becoming interesting. It's not a single observation. It's the fact that I've done this 100 times, 1,000 times. And that's where the patterns can start emerging. And that's when you can start feeding things like machine learning algorithms. Right? And that's now really stepping from a explicit definition into something that's now truly approaching machine learning or AI.
Which I think then you can see how this could spread across the entire organization when you think of, and I'm just thinking of, like, it's been a while, but I've hired people within the last year or so, so I'm going to assume it's about the same as it was when I got hired the first time.
Right.
I filled out the same information about 45 times.
Yeah, yeah. Or if you've ever been to a hospital, it's like
we just had a baby.
You fill out a form and then you walk 10 feet and you get the exact same form and you're like, did I not just fill this out? Like, 10
this
feet
is a side tangent, but I have a theory on this. We had the Calderos founder Jeremy in here on a previous episode, and we talked about all of this sort of stuff on healthcare. My theory in this is that they don't actually care. They know that the doctors are late. They're always late. And so they just hand you these pieces
stalling.
Of paper. Yeah, they're just stalling. They're giving you pieces of paper, and they're just like laughing. And it's a way for them to be able to say, well, no, sir, you were late.
That's a very dark view of
healthcare. My view on the world, well, is there a light view? You can't answer that probably, but you don't want to answer that. But no, my point in all this, the whole thing, is that there's so much redundancy.
Yeah.
And you talk about the HR process, and if I can just clean up onboarding a person from, 1,000 hours to 200 hours and weeks to days, what if every other function of the business was just slightly faster as a result of us collecting properly the first time and repopulating that information so that once they came in, really, once I signed in for my interview, my name and my email and my personal stuff that I put on the front pad on the iPad is already in the system, and now it just starts filling out the story.
So you just started going into really the heart of our story, which is this same concept. It shouldn't just be limited to onboarding. Why isn't it everywhere, right? If you look at a company, any modern company is a series of hundreds, if not thousands, of different processes, and a few of them have been plucked out and solved by point systems. So your sales processes have been pulled out and plucked off and solved by Salesforce. Your candidate interviewing process is plucked off and solved by an ATS system. Your back office financial processes plucked off, solved by SAP Finance, right, or AP. But there's still thousands and thousands of processes that aren't really being addressed. And that's really what we're after, is can we make a technology and a platform that's so simple that you're not limited to solving only the problems that are big enough that an entire industry can form around, but you have a platform, a tool that's available for you that allows you to solve each and every single one of those small processes, including and going all the way up to where you're bumping against the large processes, right? So you have maybe Salesforce, you have Workday, you have SAP, AP, and then you have your thousands of other processes that should be automated and modeled on a platform like ours.
How much money have you calculated, or if you've calculated, does this potentially stand to save organizations over time?
I think there's a lot of ways you can look at that. There's the brute force approach, which is if you look at some studies that McKinsey have done on the state of work and how automatable a lot of it is, they're estimating about 45% of all work can be automated with currently available technology. So from that perspective, you know, maybe 45%, yeah. Right? Like that's a pretty big number.
Gigantic,
that's a pretty gigantic number. But then you could start looking at other impacts. You know, will it be a lot faster? So think about the customer experience impact that Amazon has had and the expectation that it's set by a simple thing in explanation, very, very hard to do in execution, but two-day delivery. Right, like two-day delivery has ruined the world yes. for everyone else except for Amazon, because now all of our expectations are like, what, that takes 4 days to get to me? That's completely unacceptable. Yeah. It must be here in 2 days. Right. Now, it's an incredibly hard thing for Amazon to perform, but they've just set this amazing bar, and it's all about speed. So we talk a lot about costs and automation, but a lot of the opportunity really comes from being able to create new digital strategies that allow you to do something like, I'm just going to completely gut all of my competitors out by taking speed as my number one thing that I'm going to focus on. I'm going to take delivery time from 6 days to 2 days, and then I'm going to take 2 days down to 1 day, and I'm going to take 1 day down to the same day, which is where they're at now for half their products.
Right. I want to spin forward into this conversation, speaking of Jeff Bezos and his relentless pursuit of this.
Of everything.
Of literally everything. I mean, I'm sure you know this story, but if you go to relentless.com, it takes you to Amazon checkout. He bought relentless.com the same day that he bought the domain for amazon.com, and they link together. Check it out. That's an actual fact, opposed to those that are non-facts. So I want to talk about your vision, because I don't think what you're doing is all that far off.
I do not
off.
Own Relentless.
I know who owns Relentless.com.
I should look at Relentlessly, though.
You could do .ly, yes. Relentless.ly. I'm sure that's some.
Relentless.ly. Yep.
If you're a tech founder, I mean, you got to do that .ly. What you're pursuing with Catalytic is not a small endeavor either.
Right.
And so I want to talk to you more about the founder side of this. We kind of had a conversation offline about this. I'd love to pick up. Before I do that, though, the one thing I want to kind of jump in on is, you mentioned the McKinsey report on 45% more. I use the word, so I'm dark when I talk about some of the other things, but I'm positive when I talk about workers.
Yeah,
45% more productivity, not reduction of labor.
Yeah,
and the reason I say it that way is that there's this scare, and I'm sure that in time this will exist. There's no doubt. The Andrew Yang presidential campaign talking a lot about this. In time, we will find that people will have jobs that they currently have that do not exist.
Absolutely,
it has been the case forever in history.
If you just took like every 20-year gap and said, what were the top 10 jobs, 20 years ago, what are the top 10 jobs now? I'm sure they differ, right?
Yeah, I mean, 10 years ago, they said, go into journalism, and look where we look where I am.
10 years ago, you could not have been a social media star. Right?
That's true.
It's like a
and
real
I'm still
job
not,
now.
But I want to be.
Yes.
But the point I'm trying to make, though, is that I think it's important people understand when we hear this conversation that this isn't a threat. This is an ability for you workers to not have to waste your time doing the stuff that you don't. It quite honestly contributes very heavily to your depression and to your anxiety.
And worker dissatisfaction. I mean, worker dissatisfaction is at an all-time high. It's something like 30% of all employees are looking for another job. Right?
Yeah.
And the employee rate of dissatisfaction.
That's most of our audience, Sean. That's who's listening to this show right now.
Probably, that's it. But, it's a lot of people are not happy at their current jobs. And when you look at why, I mean, honestly, if 50% of your job was essentially spent being a robot, you'd be sad too, right? And so a lot of what we're trying to do is actually free them up. I think we will have a lot more productivity. We will have a lot more jobs. You know, going all the way back to the beginning of the conversation, someone has to make these automations work. Someone has to program these bots. Someone has to handle
monitor, maintain, test, and add new features.
And then eventually design, cool outfits for them and stuff like that. Yeah. Right? I'm sure that's going
to
be
cool. You have to have emojis and animojis and the whole
thing. Exactly.
But to kind of ground the point home and then move on to this, I even at Technorian, we are nowhere near the kind of operation that Catalytic or any of these businesses. We're very unique. It's sort of the show and technology development offshore and investing and so forth. But as an entrepreneur and a CEO of now multiple times and at companies, I'm very aware of happiness of my employee
yes.
and how that impacts me. And I look at it like every person who I work with, it is a little bit my responsibility to see to it that they're cared for in the job, and that transfers home, and that they're happy.
Yeah.
And so we've always worked on sort of, here are the days where physical, you need to be here.
Mm-hmm.
And here are the different tools and tactics that I've put in place for us to be able to enable our team not to come into the office on Friday and work remotely, and right. organize things in a way where they don't, you don't need to be here to do stuff that you don't want to do that's going to cause anxiety, when I know that there is a solution that is far more efficient, both financially and time-wise,
yeah.
to do. And I think that's one of the things that I love about your company. And I hope that the listeners and the other companies, that founders and CEOs, executives, decision makers who listen to the show, I hope that they look at this and go, you know, this is not only an opportunity to save money and to make more money and to be more productive, but it's also a great opportunity to make my place a more enjoyable place to work.
Yeah.
Because we don't make our employees do the same repetitive stuff again and again and again.
Yeah, and I think that's where the mission of the automation company and its origins actually become really important.
Totally.
Right, like the origin of Catalytic, we didn't actually use the word automation when we started Catalytic. What we started with, it was really a question and a hypothesis. You know, and the question that we had was, why do we spend so much of our time doing these kind of silly things that we shouldn't have to do around operations? So if you look at operations, which is a growing function of most companies, you know, when you first start, you're making everything up. But by the time you're at 100 people, probably half your work is kind of known business as usual type of stuff. And it becomes larger and larger as a percentage of your company as you get bigger. So when you're looking at these Fortune 500s, I don't know, like 85%, 90% of their work is business as usual.
Yep.
And when you look at business as usual, so much of it is really filled with these stupid things. Right. And so when we started Catalytic, we were focused, hyper-focused on that set of activities. So we're not in project management. We're not in collaboration. Those might be things that we kind of dabble in as a function of trying to solve this problem. But the problem that we were after was, why are we bad at these core operations, these repetitive business processes? And what can we do to get better around that? And automation is an outcome. It's a natural result of our looking at why we were bad. And the reason why we're bad is because so much of it is boring, mundane stuff that people don't want to do, right? So we're automating work that people don't want to do. Now, I think a very legit question is, what should people do then once you automate that work, right? And that's where we really need to spend some time talking about things like, what is it that you can actually do for your company that can transform it? So if you're not spending your time in Excel, right, or entering data into a system, what can you be doing with your time to change the customer experience? So I think the timing of automation and the rise of CX as a concept is perfect.
Yeah.
Because now we're talking about taking away these poor use of human time and putting them and funneling them into improving customer experience, which is what it's all about. And so the companies that successfully navigate that are going to obliterate the companies that don't.
I totally agree. I think just to add to that, the part that is potentially interesting, and I hate when people break outside of real math, like more than 100%, like 120%. This is legitimately, this is a legitimate yeah. application to 110 or 120% productivity, because automation yes. is going on simultaneously with human output.
Yep.
When you look at the companies, I'm going to use David Kult, who just sold Reverb to Etsy, as an example. I talked to David about this, and he is very metrics driven. Obviously, if you know him from Options Express and things, he's kind of a math guy.
Yeah.
And they had figured out a way where they could basically enable a lot of their people to spend more time in the volunteering foundation side.
Right.
And so the idea was that the business is in fact operating itself. And with the time that we've saved you, with the tools we've invested in technology wise, we would like to have you go out in the community and we will support you and pay you. You are still on the clock, but go out and do good.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
all we ask is that you do that in a Reverb Foundation t-shirt or something of that matter.
Yeah.
And now all of a sudden you've built in a way for these employees to do something for themselves, something for others, build community engagement, and you're literally getting 120% out of 100.
Yeah.
And that is, like, to me, where this goes is like there, and that's just one thing.
Absolutely.
You could have another part of the company working on new product development, just totally unrelated. There's something to be said about getting to a point where that 80% business as usual is like at least half, to yeah. McKinsey's point, automated.
Yeah, we are in a new era of thinking about employer-employee relationships where we are being much more intentional in the way we design our companies, right? And when you're being intentional in the way you design the company, you're thinking about culture, you're thinking about the jobs that people are doing. To your point about when you're a CEO, part of your job is to think about all of your employees. happiness, yep, and whether or not you're creating something for them and what their next path is. So when you are being intentional, I think you have to actually think about automation at the core. That's actually one of the reasons why smaller companies or newer companies are often able to now overtake larger incumbents, because they're starting with a much more solid core of automation. So they start right off the bat. They're not fixing things from within. They're not fixing 100 years worth of, you know, old plumbing. They started with better plumbing to begin with.
I was going to say, I always use the analogy of better tires.
Yeah.
Their tires just have a lot less flack on the tread.
Better tires, better engine,
sometimes
better alloys.
Yeah, a lot of better everything.
Yeah.
And so the kind of the next part of this, as we kind of roll this out, is as a founder, you still have to build a company and you still have to do all these things. You have to set up that 80% to be eventually business as usual process. Yeah. And we were talking offline about how a lot of success in business is managing the peak and valley. And in some ways, I kind of said that I feel like founders sometimes forget that peak and valley, there's no valley with no peak, and there's no peak with no valley. Like that is, that's what you signed up for.
Yes.
And people take a different approach. And you had kind of an interesting observation as the founder and CEO of a company that has weathered.
Yeah. Yeah. So what I was saying, and I think that this is, a lot of times you have these realizations and you're like, does everyone else already know this? And I just like have kind of just figured this out. So I don't know. This may be one of those cases. But in entrepreneur circles, you hear a lot about the roller coaster of entrepreneurship as a journey. And I think that's very true. But my aha moment was realizing what causes, I think, that roller coaster effect. And it's because the hardest part of starting a company and then growing a company is that the conditions are always changing on you in your first early year. So in your first few sales, you're going to have a totally different go-to-market motion than in your next dozen sales, than in your next 100 of sales, or if you're B2C, you know, multiply all these by 100, right? But what happens is your go-to-market motion changes. And what creates these dramatic roller coaster effects is when you just mess up the timing of abandoning one go-to-market motion that served you well in the earlier days, but now is on the descent, and you need to figure out the next one, right? So that, like, not timing them correctly is what allows you to have the ascend and then descend, and then you're just descending for too long before your next ascent starts. And sometimes you never ascend again because you have an entrepreneur who's not aware that they have to actually find their next go-to-market motion, so they just crash and burn, right? Or sometimes you don't nail it, and you end up with a gap. Sometimes you nail it, and then you end up with a very small dip or no dip at all. That's the rare story, I imagine.
See, like, the part about that that's so fascinating to me is there's a, and I'm not a huge, like, purpose, everything's purpose-driven, that's what everyone likes to say, but there's a methodical approach, and I'll use myself as a guinea pig in this, because I've certainly touched the bottom of the basin many a times, and I've smelled the clouds occasionally.
Yeah.
And I really do find that, like, and to your point, I think I only realized it actually in my head after I heard you say this. I think I maybe have been practicing sort of not intentionally, but my intention is I've created this thing, and it could be a product, it could be a process, it could be anything.
Yeah.
My expectation is that I'm not going to see dividends on this development or whatever for a good while, perhaps 3 months, 9 months, a year, 2 years sometimes. But if I'm not, and this could be on the ascent or the descent, doesn't matter. If I'm not building this, whatever it is, with the intention of X output, I think you're making a mistake when you're a founder. I think that a lot of people ride the wave and they just sort of take it as like, momentum's with us. And it's like, you did awesome, but you missed out on what I think, like, you had a false plateau. You think you hit the top. You missed by a mile.
Totally. You're like, I cracked the code. And by cracking the code, I got my Series B done, and I'm done. I'm going to start vacationing now. But what you don't realize is you cracked the code for 6 months.
Yeah.
Right?
Or you just created the momentum you're going to need to get to the real top.
Yeah, yeah. You cracked the code to get to the code to crack the code again, right?
Totally, which I think goes back to summarize this and sort of put an end cap on it, where I see this going, and I see this in you, and I see this in David, and I see this on a lot of the people that we've had on the show. There's a micro-macro mentality, and it's not, I mean, I've argued many times that you can train an entrepreneur and there's whatever, but like it goes back to how you were raised probably and your parents and just the way you viewed information as a child and on to this now. There's a certain ability to visually see and experience the world in a here is my micro daily objectives that I have to do in order to cause 5 years ahead that.
Yeah.
And you're able to view the 5 year ahead window while you're doing things today. And if you, the people who can't do that, I'm not saying they won't be successful, but I'll just put it this, the success has a ceiling.
Yeah. I think you certainly have to be willing to make that bet.
Yeah.
I think for too many people, it's too big of a bet for them to even be comfortable making. And you also have to be comfortable knowing as you're making that bet that the vast majority of those bets will fail. So how do you actually make enough bets that you can kind of double down and hone in on the ones that are succeeding? I think for a lot of people, it's too hard for them to make the bet. It's too hard for them to make enough bets. And it's too hard for them to trim out the ones that are obviously failing because they don't like making that bet. They don't like accepting failure. And one of the things with entrepreneurs is you're very aware of all your failures and you're constantly trimming them away, seeking out like the thing that is actually working, right? And that's, I think, at the heart of what makes entrepreneurs very different than someone who's not constantly gambling with their idea and the market impact.
I totally agree with you. And the gambling is a perfect way to end it because I really do think that if you're, this is like an obvious statement, right? Kind of like you'd mentioned, like this might be obvious to everybody, but it's not about risk aversion.
Yeah.
It's not even really gambling. They're strategic bets.
Yeah.
If you're out there just throwing chips on the table, like you might score.
Right.
But if you're strategically like, okay, I'm going to put a nickel here and a quarter there and a dollar there, like you know kind of what you're trying to do, and then you move the money over and it's just being intelligent.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's not rolling the dice.
No.
Right. You're
unless they're weighted.
Yes.
In which
yes.
case it is.
That's what you're trying to do. You're trying to weight it. But it is that it's a search, right? And there's you're winning through a repeat game. So even though any individual action might be a bit of a gamble, what you're betting on is over time and over many bets that you have just enough of the weighting in your favor that it will play out in your advantage. And it doesn't always. And sometimes it's the entrepreneur's fault. Sometimes it's the market's fault. I mean, that's another thing about being an entrepreneur. Not all things are in your control. And you also have to be aware of and respond to the macro environment that you can't control.
And you need to learn how to manage the machines and the investors.
Absolutely.
That's the end of the game. Sean, this has been awesome. I appreciate you taking
Thank
the
you.
Time. Where do people go to learn more about Catalytic?
Go to our website, catalytic.com. That's CatalyticCom.
Awesome. Thanks, Sean.
All right.
To invest in startups, download past episodes or apply to pitch on the Startup Showcase, check out technori.com. Stay connected by following us on social @technori, or you can follow me @Katoon. Boom. That's a wrap.